Kevin, when I at the first stage of the input from the speakers, and it's only the heading, the history, culture, the politics of the Protestant working class. And the first speaker on that there is Tony Novosel, again, Dr. Tony Novosel. So anyway, Tony, as we all know, doesn't need much introduction, and he just said that anybody who has read the book he's recently published, based on more or less on the history of the PUP and the UPF, exactly, if you only understand some segments of Lloydism within it, it's certainly a worthwhile contribution.
Thank you. And thank you for having me here today. It's a great honor to be part of this discussion, and a discussion, as you put it out, is too sorely needed. I'm conscious of the time limitations, and the speakers here said we'll keep my comments brief. I will make one point is, over the past two, I got in Monday morning and have had a series of very intense conversations with various people, and then saw the Billy play last evening, which kind of threw me up in the air with all the discussions, and I almost tried to rewrite this morning. So if you want to bring up other things with this on top of it, I'm more than happy to talk about that and what's going on in a couple of days. Anyway, to begin my presentation, let me share the following report with you. During the riots, Protestant mobs fought vicious battles with the police as well as with Catholics. So convinced were they that the police were being overrun with Catholics and that the Protestants were being maltreated by the police. Confidence in the government was at a low ebb in the Protestant community. The unionists for the area attempted to assuage a growing band of government critics by raising Protestant complaints against the police at Stormont. But such moves to preempt the anger of the extremists were notably unsuccessful. Many Protestants now began to view the Unionist Party as utterly incapable of properly promoting and defending Protestant interests. A new organization stood ready to welcome them into its ranks. They promised political action, the organization of Protestant opposition to the Unionists. Now, this sounds like something directly out of recent newspapers, opinion columns, blogs, Twitter, Facebook, and whatever social media you're looking at. However, what I did is I lifted this narrative from Graham Walker's article, Protestantism Before Party, the Ulster Protestant League in the 1930s, and changed only a few words like police for RUC and where the violence took place. Ironically, just a few years before the events that Walker described, the Protestant working class marched together with Catholic workers in the legendary outdoor relief strike riots, and just the year before, a group of Protestant workers marched from the Shankill to Bonestown as part of the Republican Congress, only to be attacked by right-wing Republicans and more likely many within their own community. I recount these incidents for a few reasons. One is to link the present problems to a larger history. More importantly, I want to illustrate the pattern that we see reasserting itself in the present difficulties between what Carolyn Gallagher in her book After the Peace describes as revanchist loyalism and political loyalism. In other words, this conflict within loyalism between those who focus only on defense of the Union and Protestantism and Orangeism, and those who, while they defend the Union, also believe that the Protestant working class has to develop its own vision of a new Northern Ireland. These political or progressive loyalists, while defending the Union and British identity, also envision a Northern Ireland that will take care of the needs of the working class, both Catholic and Protestant, and create a society in which all will share responsibility for the running of that society. Graham Spencer pointed out one of the difficulties for those attempting to move beyond the revanchist notion in his book, State of Loyalism in Northern Ireland. Spencer quotes David Adams, formerly of the UDP, who argues that within the Unionist community, I quote, there is always room for the voices that are opposed and are moving to the right, but there is very little room for the moderate voice, which tends to get stymied. If you are preaching a harder message, you always find an audience and an acceptance. If you are preaching a progressively softer line, you are an outsider. So what I would argue is over the past 6 months, like what we witnessed in 35, what Adams discerned above, and what I've already mentioned, is the recurring conflict between this revanchist, or the term I would use now, right-wing populist loyalism, and political or progressive loyalism. The harder voices, although not as extreme as the UPL, represents this new breed of right-wing populist hardline voice, a voice that only focuses on the border and the nation while ignoring the real issues the Protestant working class faces every day. Examples of this retrograde thinking have appeared in various social media. One post on Facebook called for the expulsion of all the Irish from Ulster. Another posted for calling for a new troubles. Other posts complained the government does not listen to them, and others went so far as to call the police the PSNIRA. The emergence of these voices, the examples cited above, and the rise of an extreme nationalist party is no surprise to those of you sitting in the room today. As we saw in the opening of this talk, as we know, the history of Northern Ireland is littered with examples of right-wing, extreme nationalist sentiments, either coming directly from the working class and or rural elements and or manipulated by elites within unionism. If history is any judge, then the shift to the right wing is badly for the Protestant working class, as it did in its involvement in the Ulster Unionist Labour Association in 1919, the Ulster Protestant League in 1931 onwards, the Ulster Protestant Association in 1956. They may make the union safe, but in socioeconomic terms, they will leave the Protestant working class in worse shape than when they began to defend the union in this present crisis. In effect, the Protestant working class will return to a life where the important issues of political, economic, and social marginalization, along with educational underachievement and social deprivation, will continue to exist and may get worse. Even more damaging is the fact that, just as my research has shown, unless something within the community itself changes dramatically, it will remain without a coherent and forward-thinking political leadership and will be at the mercy of those who, as one of my interviewees once put it, do not have our best interests at heart. Now, this is not to downplay the threat to the union that each group saw in the periods I mentioned above. In each of these periods, just as today, where the argument is that Republicanism lost the war but is winning the peace, and that Sinn Féin has launched a cultural war against unionism, loyalism, and Protestantism, one could argue that the threat to the union was Israel and that they needed to defend Ulster. However, what is also clear throughout the history of Northern Ireland, when the working class fell in behind these right-wing populist leaders, or even move further to the right of those leaders, the working class actually lost out in socioeconomic terms. At the same time, this support for this brand of populism, as we saw through the present era, 1969 to today, in its defense of Ulster, did not result in domestic stability, nor in the strengthening of the nation. Having said all this, we know from our studies in each of these periods, elements within the working class came forward and espoused progressive politics to display a more moderate voice. Voice we know could not, for the most part, make itself heard enough to make a real difference in the politics of the Protestant working class in Northern Ireland. In 1919-20, when unionist-inspired expulsions took place in the shipyard, real trade unions tried to work in the interest of all the working class. Those who fought on behalf of all workers found themselves labeled with rotten prods and faced the same expulsions and violence as Catholic workers. As we know, workers from the Protestant community joined together in the outdoor relief riots in 32. For common economic goals. And I acknowledge here right up front that this was not a political movement, but a largely economic one. This coalition collapsed over the next 3 years. The first Progressive Unionist Party was set up in 38 and quickly disappeared from the political scene when the national elections centered on a De Valera constitution. The NILP in the 60s represented a move forward on economic and social concerns of the working class, but disintegrated during the conflict. The VPP in 1974 came and went for various reasons. The PUP emerged again in the 1980s and 1990s as it re-emerged in the present climate. Like the VPP, it emerged from exclusively Protestant working class tradition and began to imagine an Ulster where the progressively softer line would lead to a better life for all in Northern Ireland. However, as we know, none of these enjoyed great success in making a political difference, the PUP in the 1990s being the notable exception. With a surge in membership now at the 1990s level, we should watch closely the impact of PUP will have as a progressive political force. I won't speak to this as Billy is here, and he will do a much better job on this than I will. What I will say, I'm getting close to the end here, is that based on my research and those others that have focused on this topic, whenever Protestant working class focuses or focus strictly on the border and Britishness, while ignoring or putting on the back burner the really tough issues like education, socioeconomic issues, social deprivation, and on, it found itself in worse shape than the crisis began. And a thought came to my mind as I was putting this together, and it comes from Patty Devlin's Yes, We Have No Bananas. When talking about the mid-1920s, a time of high unemployment and social deprivation, he writes, "While the Protestant worker was in uniform in the streets as an auxiliary policeman combating IRA activities, his employer was reducing his wages for the same patriotic reason." I have no policy suggestions, as I am not a social scientist in the sense of you, many of you in this room is, nor am I a public policy analyst, nor am I someone from the community, as many of you are, who work with these problems every day. And nor would I presume to recommend to the Protestant working class what it should do now and in the future. I can only state, as I tried very briefly to do above, what it should not do. Naturally, by arguing by what I believe what went wrong puts me in a camp of arguing that the Protestant working class must focus not only on the flag and national issues, important as they are to it, but must focus on the issues that affect its everyday life. It must avoid going down the road of right-wing populism. These options lead only to a dead end. So to conclude, I'm taken back to a 1977 combat article called Think or Perish, which analyzed Gusty Spence's July 12, 1977 speech. Taking on board Spence's harsh, even brutal criticisms of the reactionary elements within unionism and loyalism, the articles wrote and argued, "We espouse the populism for fear that we would be branded as disloyal by the vast army of super prods who have so much to say and so little to offer, and that populism is no substitute for truth. Today, the Protestant working class faces the same dilemma and decision, and in the famous phrase, finds itself at a crossroads again. At this crossroads, it would do well to heed the final words of Think or Perish. Those of us who rejected the philosophy of right for the philosophy of populism in the past have been proven wrong. Let us not make the same mistake twice in so short a period of time." Thank you.